Father, maybe we could swing into where he talks about Buddhism and the Eastern thought. And
all right, this has been playing a constant counterpoint to his thought throughout this book. That is, he's already mentioned it four or five times, that the perfect parody of these central Western and Christian truths are presented to us very much by the Buddhistic and the Hindu and also the less known Taoistic philosophies of the East. And because we're being inundated with those today as never before, much more so than in Chesterton's day, this particular chapter, The Romance of Orthodoxy, where he develops that at great length, is a very important chapter for us. Because I think even we in the Church have a rather strange notion about what it means to be spiritual. And it's a notion that actually comes from the East and not so much from the West. That is, we think of spirit as being very fine, very rarefied, kind of like air. In fact, we know the word itself, spiritus, and the Greek word pneuma, from which we get in like pneumatic tires, comes from the word breath, wind, because two qualities of the air are similar enough to the qualities of what we mean by spirit, namely that it's invisible and yet it's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It's invisible, but it has a presence, so it can knock us over if the wind gets strong enough. So we have applied that to the non-material world. However, that does not mean that the non-material world is somehow less real, kind of tenuous and misty and vague, and hazy.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to think the more spiritual that you get, the more kind of hazy and vague and light that you would get. Actually, spiritual realities are the most solid realities that could possibly exist. God is not material. God is a pure spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And all the angels are pure spirits, and they are very solid. They're not solid in a physical sense, but they're solid in the sense that they're there,
mm-hmm.
and they're immovable. That there's an ontological fullness there.
Such an important insight you're sharing, because we think the material world, something like this or steel or something, is the real reality, but these are the things that crumble and decay and rust and rot eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so although Chesterton makes the very strong point that we first do greet the universe, and the physical universe,
right.
It's there and it's real, and it is our first doorway to approaching God. When we talk about God, the first thing we say about him is he's the one who made all of this.
Mm-hmm.
He's the cause of all of it. We have to first start with the effect in order to reach the cause.
Mm-hmm.
But once we reach the cause, if we're thinking properly, we realize that the cause, if he made all of this material solidity, he must be in his spiritual way even more solid, or he couldn't have created this solidity.
Right.
So it's important to realize that the spiritual world and the spiritual life is a world and a life full of realities that are even more real than this already very real external world that we live in.
And he was just simply echoing in many ways what Aristotle had taught.
Right, that was Aristotle's, really his great contribution, was the substantiality of these contingent things that are all around us. Well, what does this have to do with the romance? We talked about in the last show that it is the fixity of the principle or of the rule or of the law that enables us to fight, enables us to carry on a crusade, enables us to have something to live for, and something to pursue, a goal, enables us to progress. This goal, however, that we are approaching, and which makes our life a romantic adventure, because there's a possibility we might not make it. You know, where it's not a guaranteed thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's there are free wills all around us, not only our own free will, but the free wills of all the people around us, and God is free. You know, so it makes the world very, very exciting, but also very perilous. Nonetheless, that goal that we are approaching is God, and for us is the New Jerusalem, which will be the final union of angel, man, and material universe in its final glorified perfection. That is a very solid and a very spiritualized reality, and we're moving forward towards that. That is why we fight. That is what we should be loving. We should love God, and we should love God in that dwelling, in that future city that we're moving towards. And there are many, particularly inspired by the fallen angels, who are trying to divert us from that, tempt us away from that, mm-hmm. and providing us a bogus version of spirituality, a spirituality that is not of God, a spirituality that is produced by the angels that fell away from God's mystery, the angels that fell away from the fullness of God's solid being, mm-hmm. and fell down, fell away from their own full splendor, and therefore are constantly trying to make themselves mysterious. Our true mission on this earth, which is to participate in the building up of that very solid dwelling place of God, when God will say, as it says, he says in the book of the Apocalypse, now here is the dwelling of God among men. Mm-hmm. God created the universe at the beginning to be his house, to be a place where he could dwell, and we kicked him out of it with sin. And now he is starting slowly to build back up a dwelling place. First he gave the little tiny tabernacle that was taken through the desert, mm-hmm. and then the temple of Jerusalem, and then the cenacle where our Lord celebrated the first Mass, and then all of the churches around the world. And then suddenly, slowly I should say, we're beginning to move towards that expansion of the tabernacle through all of creation so that God will be able in the New Jerusalem to dwell in his creation. And the fallen angels are working day and night against that. They want to keep him out of that. Keep him out of here. This is our domain. I'm the prince of the world, mm-hmm. Lucifer says. And it's true. God left him that power. He is the prince of the world now. And he is the one that we are fighting. And all I'm trying to say here is that what Chesterton is trying to say in this chapter is that the great attack against this mission of the church today, I think the greatest overt attack is the communist attack, mm-hmm. on the political and economic sphere. Right. But the greatest spiritual attack is on the Eastern religious sphere. We're being inundated by these gurus, by these swamis, and by these books, mm-hmm. that 90% of them are nonsense. They don't have any depth to them at all, but there are a few that are very good. We look back to this romance again. The guru will tell you, look, you fall in love with someone, one day you're going to get hurt. Hmm. As sure as anything, you're going to get hurt. And the Western tradition says, well, yes, it's true. Jesus himself took that upon himself too. He loved us so much that he got hurt more than anyone else. I mean, love makes you vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But it also, it allows your heart to be broken. But for us in our state of original sin, our hearts need to be broken in order to be opened. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're going to stay closed and hard as a rock for all eternity. And what the guru is trying to lead us to, he's leading us away from reality, leading us away from our personality. The thing that is wrong with us, he says, is precisely our personality. The creation was the fall. Chesterton says that in here somewhere. The creation itself was the fall. And therefore, you see on the faces of the Buddhas and of the gurus very often this very indifferent look, or often the eyes are closed altogether. And Chesterton contrasts here. The Buddhist saint always has his eyes shut, while the Christian saint always has them very wide open. The Buddhist saint has a sleek and harmonious body, but his eyes are heavy and sealed with sleep. The medieval saint's body is wasted to its crazy bones, but his eyes are frightfully alive. There cannot be any real community of spirit between forces that produce symbols so different as that. So Chesterton begins here with the artwork. He himself was an artist, continued to be an artist, and he first noticed very often, this isn't always true, but very often the typical Eastern sage is the one who's looking inward. Mm-hmm. The typical Western sage is the one who has eyes like John Paul II or like Mother Teresa. They're very eyes full of peace, eyes that also can have an interior life. Obviously, they do have an interior life, but they're eyes that are looking out in love at the world. What can I do? How can I serve? Right. I care. You know, it hurts me to see you suffering.
Some of the implications of this Eastern philosophy would be that there could be no incarnation and God would not have become man, I should think. No sacraments.
Right, there would be no need for it because, finally, for them, there is no difference between you and me, between God, mm-hmm. and the world. We're all just one big person, right? And this is the mystery,
to yourself,
of, yeah. mystery of love. And here somebody, someone who's listening probably will say, no, wait, I think you're pushing that too far. I just read a book, they would say, about the compassionate Buddha. That Buddha was full of compassion. And that there is also the ideal in Buddhism of the so-called bodhisattva. That is a person who who delays his own entrance into nirvana, this final state of perfection, in order to help others attain that too. And they say, you know, isn't that charity? Well, we would say certainly there is a reflection there. There's Buddhism and Hinduism are not 100% in error at all. Mm-hmm. There's lots of Egyptian gold that we could harvest out of these religions, obviously. We talk about the mysterious East, mm-hmm. and for us the humdrum West. The West is humdrum because we don't know it. We don't know our own tradition. The more you study Western spirituality, the great Western, mm-hmm. Just the great classical Western philosophers and thinkers and poets, and of course spiritual writers, mm-hmm. you'll discover we have the mysteries. Perhaps we could take a brief look at the very final chapter, mm-hmm. because it's quite significant, as perhaps many of the viewers have already discovered. Chesterton wrote this book before he became a Roman Catholic. He wrote this book. This book came out in 1908, and he didn't become a Roman Catholic until 1922.
That's amazing.
There are many reasons for that. One of the big ones was because his wife, he had come to Christianity largely through his wife. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the reason he became an Anglican. And she drug her feet a long time with the Catholic Church in mm-hmm. England at that time. It was a considerable step to take. Anglican church in their little town, I saw it, a big, beautiful Gothic church. I mean, a Catholic church they stole away, of course, back in the 16th century, but it turned it into an Anglican church. The Catholic church, when he was finally baptized, it was a little shack behind a pub. Mm-hmm. Since then, they built a church largely through Chesterton's contributions. But it was a big step for him. And he had already intellectually converted when he'd written this book. His complete moral conversion followed a little bit later, although mm-hmm. It's a complex story, and you never can really get inside of somebody's conscience. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, the final chapter of this book is called Authority and the Adventurer. And he had written at the very beginning of the book, at the end of the first chapter, I add one purely pedantic note, which comes, as a note naturally should, at the beginning of the book. These essays are concerned only to discuss the actual fact of the central Christian theology, that the central Christian theology is the best root of energy and sound ethics. They are not intended to discuss the very fascinating but quite different question of what is the present seat of authority for the proclamation of that creed. He said, I think if he had rewritten this book later in his life, this is the only thing he would have changed, because he discovered later it is not a quite different question at all, mm-hmm. that he already was himself in the church intellectually and drawing in his lights from the authority. Because after discovering the paradoxes, discovering these wild conditions, the dangers of reality, revolution, yes. and the romance, he said, finally, if we're going to have balance at all, there has to be an authority. Somebody, whoever made this thing, whoever is the author of this story, must also be the authority of the people that are in the story. And so if we're going to have an adventure, a real adventure, we have to know something about the authority who is going to lead us, show us the way, who is qualified to show us the way mm-hmm. to the goal. And that is the question he begins to approach in this last book. He doesn't get all the way to the Roman Catholic Church yet, although there's not a word in here that would not apply mm-hmm. perfectly to the church.
Well,
but he does arrive at that conclusion.